Welcome to the Telehealth and Medicine Today Journal Unscripted podcast series, where research and innovation collide. Today's topic launches a new series featuring the enterprise perspective for publishing what you've proven. Speakers are TMT editorial board members, Dr. Paul Barrick, principal at J. Barrett Innovation, and chief medical officer at Penguin, Sandeep Bhatt, former senior leader, digital engagement, global clinical operations at GSK, and Dr. William C.B. Harding, professor at Trine University, NSF reviewer, and Medtronic Distinguished Technical Fellow. Let's get right into it.
Hi, everybody. My name is Dr. Paul Barrick. I'm a clinician scientist at Thomas Jefferson University, and I've been involved with overseeing, doing, supporting, and coaching research efforts for about 30 years. Today, I'll be moderating a panel, From Innovation to Evidence, Why Enterprise Digital Health Research Must Be Shared. And hopefully we'll have a very vibrant discussion, lots of questions, both around research, around digital, around enterprise, how it all comes together, and also, what does this all mean for the journal? What does it mean for publications? What does it mean for supporting research? And at the end of the day, how does this all come to support patient wellness, patient outcomes, and community outcomes? So again, if we think about, as you're hearing the introductions of our two panelists, enterprise digital health obviously is generating a lot of information, and we want to better understand, is that evidence worthwhile? Most of it doesn't reach the broader set of readers and policymakers. We're going to try to explore some of that and what needs to change, if there does need to be a change, and how does that change transpire into actually building shared knowledge. So I'm going to ask each of the panelists to introduce themselves, and then I'll be asking questions. And I've told them to interrupt me as often as possible if they want to push back or ask a question. And so hopefully this will be more of a more vibrant, interactive discussion than a traditionally, you know, plenar conversation. So I'll start with Sandeep. Can you briefly introduce yourself and why you're so interested in this topic?
Sure. Hey, folks. My name is Sandeep Bhatt, trained as a bioengineer from Penn, first love in medical imaging, and had spent quite a bit of time in that space, moved over to life sciences some years ago. I work in, when I say life sciences, biopharma, traditionally in the area of clinical research, and have been doing research that is considered post-academic research. So we're talking about enterprise research in large companies, small companies, entrepreneurs, and startups.
Thank you. Liam?
Sure. I'm Dr. William Harding. I go by Liam. It's Irish for William, L-I-A-M, so you can call me Liam. So I actually emerged from the missile technology. I worked at Cape Canaveral and missile tracking and other aspects of it. Moved into drug interdiction for U.S. Customs and Navy, and then Energizer power systems for rechargeable. But that was just my start, because then I found my love of biomedical engineering. And you think, well, all just engineering, just look at it a little differently. So I moved into working for Medtronic for over 25 years in the innovation, advanced innovation groups, led our technical fellows organization, have quite a few patents, published materials, specifically in innovative healthcare devices, solutions, and software, including, and then started working actually for Trine University as a professor in the doctoral program for IT, systems engineering, where I continue to publish, mentor, and work with quite a few students.
So thank you for that. So, the biggest why question, first of all, is what is enterprise research? People define it as, what comes out of companies, lots and lots of internal data, much of it never reaches the broader audience, never gets properly evaluated, often never gets assessed for its bias and opportunities for impact. So there's the question. Maybe we'll start by saying that, why does so much enterprise research stay inside the companies? Sandeep?
I think that sometimes it's not as recognized as being externally valuable. I want to say it in the right way. A company does enterprise research for its own reasons, whether that's to advance science, whether it's advancing their own operations, their manufacturing technology, or even something as corporate as their records for human data or their HR legal records. But all of that involves a sense of openness and understanding that we traditionally call research in the research space. You asked a very important question as to why it's not, I mean, enterprise is, a for-profit entity, but why it's not being shared out is that one reason I mentioned is that it's not thought of possibly as explainable to someone outside. But if we also think of it as it's this, it could be very similarly done in multiple enterprises. I mentioned a couple examples in some business areas that could be repeatable. It is something that happens in multiple areas, which may not have a standard. Maybe there's no framework, but it is a running set of operations. And so I look at it as people just don't know. They don't know that it's valuable to someone else.
So let's take that on face value. What I'm hearing from you is that the barriers are not regulatory or competitive or methodological. In fact, they're kind of cultural. They're internal cultural aspects of the company, but there are no external barriers that should keep this from being more widely disseminated, right?
And I'd only ask is that there's always that thing of going from zero to one, creating pilots, and then pilots to adoptions and scale. We have these fancy words out there that we work with every day now. Sometimes you're thinking of things that, as you said, it's a perception issue, a cultural issue that really takes heart and soul because we think of, oh, it's our data. And what we're not trying to do is share your data, but you can share the way you've done it, your process, your optimization, the benefits you've done in terms of output and clarity, the ability of changing people's minds and understanding and making them better employees. And so all of that is unforeseen extreme value. And it's just not it's not something that people think about first and foremost, but you're right. That's exactly what, right, Paul.
And there's this great story about IBM. So IBM used to have 50,000 patents that they would mostly keep in a big safe. And about 10 years ago, when the IBM executive turned over, the new executive decided to give out most of these to the public and make them available. And their business dramatically rose after they released all these patents. In fact, what the market said was, while the patents are interesting, what's more interesting is that you have this entire depth and bench of people that can take these ideas to the market, even though there's not enough validation yet. So, Lee, maybe you can tackle this innovation evidence gap question. So, companies move quickly, rigorous evidence takes a lot of time. So, how does a company, an organization, balance the innovation speed with the scientific validation? So, when is evidence good enough to deploy?
And it's a really good question. And specifically, even in addressing what Sandeep had said relative to some of the barriers to this material being out in the open sourced or whatever, and I take the perspective of, coming from Medtronic, nearly 100,000 employees, largest in the world medical device manufacturer, is though it may be perceived that information is not getting out, we recognize, and I'll use my group, my technical fellows group, which is about 488 people. Half of them have PhDs, if, whatever. So everybody's really into that mindset of research and how to conduct evidence-based, create evidence-based material. But the driving factor for why it's not publicly known is IP, trade secrets, patents, and stuff was our bread and butter. So when I think about a process in manufacturing a device, and this would be when we say enterprise, we use that term here. I think of it in the sense across the industry, across the business, the group, business groups and sectors, and then outside of the into the industry. And when I look at that and think that my method for, we'll say, deconstructing a hybrid board or a circuit board to figure out what went wrong, it could be the Coke syrup recipe. It could be something that makes my company lose its market lead. So I have to consider that if I expose this, what could it cost my company in trying to lead in the industry? So though we recognize that we couldn't publish everything, we had internal sources. I was part of the IP review teams. So we actually had our own science conferences, everything else. We heavily vetted information before it could go out. We wanted to publish everything for the world, but it wasn't always possible. So when you look at COVID and respiratory systems, we saw the need to publish that so everybody could benefit from it.
And Liam,
But in the general aspect of not hurting the industry. Go ahead.
you're primarily focusing on hardware, not necessarily software.
No,
Or,
not at all.
yeah.
No, this is 100% software and hardware. When I look at the software that I've used to relative to inductive coupling, a deep brain stimulation device, or the MES system, and some of the things we've done to, for manufacturing or supply chain things, we have actually patents on these things. There are some aspects that we've developed, in building this code that we could not release to the rest of the world, or it gives away our Coke syrup. And
Sure,
so,
sure.
yeah.
But the reason I ask that is, as you know, the FDA has had for a long time and codified at least for 10 years a rigorous requirement for a human factors assessment before one goes to market. That's not the case in software. Software, in many ways, has had a much, much lower threshold for sharing that data with the public. In fact, a lot of companies regularly market pretty empty claims that their watch will avoid heart attacks, and this device will allow you to prevent hypertension spikes, but they're not required to actually show the data that we do in hardware. And,
Maybe
recently,
not the data. Maybe not the data, but the models, the methodologies, some of the formulas, some of these things can be shown. And you can use like convolutional neural networks when you think about and analyzing models without disclosing the data. Actually, there were quite a few software systems that I worked on that have had the same rigor applied to them, whether it was process control systems, firmware, embedded in pacers, whatever, pacemakers and neural devices had to follow the same rigor as the hardware.
It's good to hear. Of course, the question again is the reason why so much of this doesn't get published, is it because of the scientific rigor barrier, which you're arguing it's not? Is it fear
Correct.
of negative results? And so that safe space, if you will, that sandbox where you want to have rigorous input, where do you, in the past, it used to be so much it was under wraps. Now there's a growing democratization, if you will, of data.
Right.
Where is the right sweet spot for companies in 2026 about sharing more of those data sets, more of their pre-market data in order to build the case for the rigor that you're alleging?
Well, and that's where, when I think of business agreements that we make with partners and third parties and aspects of those, that's where that comes in. When we recognize there is a risk, we always look at, how misinformation or AI system analysis, like even the use of our own internal AI systems to make sure the LLMs weren't being shared to the rest of the world. We followed very strict rigor because we've all come from that academic background. But when it came to actually sharing, we always had to mitigate the aspects of human data, things that might be identifiable if it hasn't been properly de-identified. Could it get back to these patient groups, whatever?
And
But it was always one of those things we wanted to focus. Go ahead.
and 10 years ago, there were almost no hacking of records, and now there's close to
Correct.
500 million personal records hacked per year.
Easily.
Yeah,
Yeah.
and
If you
so.
look at the book we just published in October, it was specifically around securing a connected future. And that was the whole emphasis of how many things are hacked. Here's the ways to mitigate it. Here's the ways to protect yourself. So 100% true.
So Sandeep, when you think about credible evidence for enterprise-based research, who should be responsible for proving that, say, digital apps or digital software tools, who's responsible for proving that these technologies work? Is it the company? Is it the buyer? Is it an independent evaluator? Is it the guy who has chronic heart disease? Who's responsible, not just legally, morally, and kind of professionally? Where should the onus of responsibility for the scientific rigor that Liam was talking about, where should it be in enterprise?
I'll give you my most refreshed and most current roles have involved what we call eCOA, digital biomarkers, measurements that are self-driven either from a human qualitative response or a machine medical measurement response of something that's non-human, of which your question fantastically says who actually creates proof, validity, acceptance. And I'm going to rewind it by saying that in our space, in looking at digital health, few years ago, you mentioned it was very nascent. These ideas were non-existent. We're going from pilots now to something larger. So basically, what I'm trying to tell you is there's a larger attend. There's a lot more attendance. There's a lot more attention. So we take those pilots and we take them to infrastructure. We actually try to make it regularly in place, whether that's in a company, in a formal company, or whether it's out there in the field. And so, because you have a larger amount of need, people have, as you said, a need to say, "Well, prove it. What really makes it work? What makes it accepted?" And so, first, we a few years ago, we thought of the idea of adoption. It's really not enough. We want to look, as you mentioned, evidence, accountability, if it's reproducible, if it's provable, if it's compliance driven, if it's acceptable across every human or patient, caregiver, parent, allowable. And so, there's no real right answer. If I take it the other way from people who work with larger mathematical amounts of information, they think of it as almost market driven, or we'll know that if there's expansion or contraction of things, we do have, regulators, we do have payers that are insurance companies, we'd have clinician bodies, we have patient groups, we have caregiver groups. There are parts, and what I'm going to consider those is market forces. There are groups of evidence of people. A journal such as highly respectable one here being hosting this call, they prove to a certain level. So you bring a lot of research, possibly what I'm going to say, if it's unpublished right now, it becomes invisible. The point is you make it visible, you go through one of these mechanisms, the patient groups, the compliance, the clinician, or publishing to a journal, and it becomes real. That is the proof. So I'm giving you a general answer because
Sure,
obviously
sure.
that's
So
a
here,
pretty wide
I guess the
question.
follow-up question for then is, where do partnerships from companies with non-for-profit spaces, that could be NGOs, it could be patient groups, it could be academia, where do those partnerships live, and why isn't there more robust support for those and funding for those types of private, public, or for-profit, not-for-profit partnerships that would support wider circulation of those data and information?
Easy answer for that one also is that I'll go back to the space where I'm in clinical research. There are people who think of what is the competitive nature of the process. So, for example, there are multiple collaboratives, nonprofit collaboratives that are partnerships. And the point is, we're competing on basically a medical molecule or medical ther a therapeutic or a diagnostic. But what we try to add on is the wrapper, the process to get it advanced faster. There's a lot of these nonprofits, partnerships, and collaboratives and associations that try to bring people to the table. There are unfortunately certain of those people in the, let's just say, competitors that don't want to come to the table because they think a part of their IP, as Leah mentioned, or that part of their secret sauce is those things that are actually non-competitive. And so they don't contribute to the advancement. And then that's where we have stymies of advancing things that are as common as a standard or standard language. We don't have everyone come to the table. And so it's not that they're being renegades or they're thinking offshoot. They just are not thinking of the right definition. They're not coming together as a common definition. So we have to think of common definitions. We have to think of common standards, as you said. We have to find the right outputs of where this information can be brought in, but it's an existing current challenge. It will always be a current challenge. But I think that if you look at your core enterprise and who you are and what's your identity and take everything out, you need to compete on that only, then go to those collaboratives, nonprofits, partnerships,
Or
because we'll all
maybe
benefit from it.
now, there's an agency in the US, and Liam, this is for you. It's called PCORI. And PCORI is a private-public partnership that has a budget of about $500 million, and they were set out to design research and outcome questions that must be 100% in partnership with patients, communities, in short, the PCORI, the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research
Institute.
Institute, argues that all research must begin and end with the client, the customer, the patient, the community in the equation. This is quite different than how a lot of companies think. Now, I've worked with Medtronic for about 20 years, and they're probably at the tippy top of the best governed companies in the world. At 100,000 people, that's a big ecosystem. That's very different than most of the companies that are out there now in the software space. So for a company like Medtronic, do you need to work with consumers and patients, or can do you have
Oh,
enough
yeah.
inside incentives, data standards, and rigor to say that might be true for small companies, but we have so much experience and so much breadth that we can usually do most of that inside our own ecosystem without having to publish interim products, interim data sets, interim products. Just wait till we have the final solution. So here's the question. For smaller companies, what would be the advice coming from a large company like Medtronic about building and changing the way we do future research, if we assume that we can have a bigger bang for our buck, buck being time, money, people, in order to expand the innovation opportunities?
Well, and I love this question because it also ties back to some of the things that Sandeep had indicated around the different groups, caregivers and so on. It goes back to what you had mentioned, I think, before the recording about stakeholder groups. And it even touches on one of the things that even Sandeep had said about adoption is if I look at a small company, and just to let you know, is within Medtronic, I was often sent to smaller companies that we wanted partnership with to help them understand, we'll say, everything from government to local rules, laws, whatever, on how to get their efforts, solutions, whatever, through the process. So to make sure they could be successful. So, and then even Medtronic have embraced a philosophy of spinning out small groups so we could be more lean to do what we needed to do without all the rigor, without all the overhead, get it, and then bring ourselves back in. But one of the biggest issues in the enterprise or larger organizational type scenarios is pretty much arrogance. Arrogance and myopic views on innovation and concept. And I say arrogance in the sense that, when I've been in teams before, we're going to go work on an MS solution, a person with MS, and design thinking is the tools that we're using, and suddenly everybody goes away in their office. I'm going to solve MS. But that wasn't the patient's needs. That wasn't their pain points. So they actually missed the pretty much the need. So it really points when I talk
You
about,
think the
hold on one
product?
second, let me finish a little part of here, is in the stakeholder part, is you really have to engage all the stakeholders, not just the end user. The customer could be your manufacturing floor technician. It could be your patient. It could be your caregiver. And adoption is only one segment of the life cycle. You have to start from the decision-making all the way to decommissioning. So people, when I say myopic, they think too narrowly around who are the stakeholders, what who needs to be engaged,
I
and
mean,
what really represents the life cycle.
100%. I
Sorry.
mean, so 95% of medical-related healthcare startups are perceived to have failed as based on their mission statement or based on their original requirements. 95%. And I get asked as an advisor to help these companies when they fail. And often I find that many of the building blocks that any industrial engineer working on hardware around usability and human factors and process mapping and task analysis, these fundamental applied systems engineering tools are often either overlooked or the steps are cut short because of an urgency to go to market. Would you
Exactly.
agree with that overall assessment?
100%. That is exactly the right. And as a matter of fact, in a little humorous scenario, this has occurred both inside and outside of the company where we're preparing for regulatory, we're preparing for FDA approval, and you'll go to an engineer and you'll say, okay, show me your validation document, show me this. And the person goes through their bio and telling their credentials. It's like, okay, that's very nice, but where is your documents? And they look at you plainly thinking, oh, so in other words, when the FDA comes here and says, who validated it? It's like, go see Ziggy. Well, in the same case, engineers will be hired on as third party. They'll say, well, I'm an engineer. You hired me for my electrical background. Why are you going to check my work? And it's just that type of mentality, unfortunately, is, it's when we think about evidence base, when we think about our credibility as PhDs, whatever, we know it's not, that doesn't solve all our problems. That doesn't mean we know everything.
Course.
You have to have the evidence. You have to prove.
So Sanjeev, do you think that if the incentives were changed around publishing evidence, publishing early data sets and early algorithms and tools of that nature, sort of what general years and years ago when the chip wars were happening in the 70s and a concept of Motorola's CEO came out with the concept of co-competition, whereby sharing certain parts of the discovery chain, the entire field would accelerate and the competition would be on the quality of the products. So the question is, wouldn't sharing more of that, like IBM did, be a competitive advantage rather than a risk to the innovation to the company?
Yep, there's 3 points. One is absolutely. So I'll rewind it and say, and going to a little bit, I want to answer a little bit of what Liam also answered. Sometimes when you don't have all the people in the room, you are thinking of all these stakeholders. There's possibly others that are of more value and actually or make the difference. You just never invited them in. And so drug development, we think of a lot of things and we don't bring the right patient group in, or we don't bring enough ad boards out to bring those thoughts into the thought process of where you are, and you're going ahead and you bring them either too late or you don't include them. So non-inclusiveness of certain people is very important. Second, to go to what you're saying about like the whole idea of like being transparent, I think is the good way to put it, and seeing if there's economics around it. We should be more transparent. At the end of the day, if you work in an enterprise, you're working with one, and if it could be the size of the companies you're talking about, that could be the large mega company, it still may not succeed in that large company. And so now we have concepts such as repurposing medication or second line or the idea of business development licensing. We outlicense something to a smaller company, which could do marvels with whatever's been done to that stage. And so that's there. And the third that I think that's just as important as you mentioned as giving, it's not giving away, but giving partial away, is that there are others that could do better with that later stage work. And this happens all the time in all of our lives, is that we might have done something that could be thought of futuristic. It's supposedly done now, but I think it's more valuable in the future. Sometimes it's paused. In many cases of enterprise research, it's buried into the ground and it's never remembered again. And they redo everything, all the data, all the reconstruction, all the re-experiments, all the redoing of the information. And so reusability is a really big thing, at least to me myself, in what I've done before in my early days. I mentioned medical imaging. So I realized that a picture is 1,000 words. Now an image is worth millions of words. And so we don't need sometimes to look at things, as you said, transparently. If IPs are shared or even partial let sets of research are shared, the sharing is just as valuable. The company will have a better look and feel from a public persona sense. And we're still,
Sanjeev,
unfortunately, reputationally not looked on as one of the,
so
the best in the industry.
are you arguing a socialistic or a capitalistic? Are you saying this is about the ecosystem of companies, or are you saying that this is better for the profit bottom line as well?
I'd like to say that it's both because, these companies are capitalistic. That's why they're there. They're trying to make obviously their way in the world, but it's not socialistic. It is actually, I'd say, humanistic, and humanistic is all of us. And this is where I take anyone who is listening to this and is a participant in the audience membership. It's very different than any place else you worked. Healthcare, any human being is a technically, it could be a customer. And so it's not in any other industry where I say, as you mentioned, humanistic is very much higher value than socialistic or capitalistic. Anyone could get sick. Anyone could get develop an issue. Anyone could actually be considered, the driving their wellness and longevity criteria, if you think of both sides. But
So,
there's no other place like that where we think of everybody. That's why I'd rather not bucket them into those two categories. It's not
And if
bucketing
you
them.
don't mind me adding into that, is
Crazy,
Sandeep, I
yeah.
love the aspect of humanistic. It makes perfect good sense and even goes back to Paul saying, who should be questioning? Who should be asking these questions? Is this valid? And everybody who's a stakeholder, from the developer to the regulatory to the end user, everybody, the doctor, caregiver, which is often eliminated, everybody should. So I love your perspective on that.
So I want to go step back a little bit to the level of evidence. So I have been schooled and do a lot of randomized controlled trials, and a lot of RCTs have come under fire because most of them cannot be replicated. And the lack of replication leads to an undermining of trust. And ultimately, when you have undermining of trust in standards or frameworks, ultimately people then publish poor stuff or unvalidated, which then means more and more things have to be pulled out of the market and the prototypes take longer. And so the question, Liam, is, going forward over the next several years, what do you think will be the standard? Enough data? Will it be real-world evidence, digital trials, health outcomes reporting? What will be enough for companies to go forward, serious companies? And what needs to change in these companies in order to have the skill sets to be able to improve these non-randomized but other types of evidentiary frameworks so that they can package their data and data sets and make them more widely available?
And that's a very good question. And one of the things to even add to that aspect of it is, and I'll use an example of the Medtronic because that's what I'm most familiar with, is when we were building a new technology, and we say, okay, we're going to release this, we'd get people in the United States say, well, hey, I just heard about you released this new diabetic pump, or you did this. Yeah, we did that 5 years ago in Europe because it's still valid, it's still evidence-based, but the process, the governance, everything was easier, without, we'll say, all the rigmarole that we experience a lot of times in the United States, is to get material out and still with the safety of the patient, still with the validity of the technology solutions, hardware, software, data, still with that in mind. But bringing it back to the United States just would slow the process down. So I often thought, why are we so bogged down when we have evidence here that shows this is a good solution that we can't release this here? We even face in some countries that we couldn't release a very good solution because it was inexpensive. And the perception was that it had to be expensive to be a very good product. So
And
there was
Liam,
a
could
lot of
you,
perceptions we had to
of
change.
course,
Go ahead.
could you give an example of a product or service line where that is has
Oh,
been?
100%. We were actually going for a pacemaker, and we think not a defibrillator. It's a single chamber pacemaker, as example. Bradycardia, a slow beating heart scenario, where the person just needs some basic therapy. And we tried, we actually tried to release this in China. And it's not a criticism, but it's the perception that we were able to produce a pacemaker that was only $200 to pretty much manufacture and very little for the consumer to purchase versus a $40,000 or $30,000 device. But the perception was it's inexpensive, it must not be high quality. Yet it was based on the same principles of some of our first pacemakers. It used an off-the-shelf battery, so it was a very reliable battery. It was still tested, but was very commonly available. The circuit board was very basic. The capacitance, all the components were correct, and the leads were well known. It was such a solid device, that it maybe it was just too good, but it literally didn't go to market because of the perception that it was inexpensive, therefore it wasn't good.
Do you
So,
have
good.
a couple of final closing round questions? So first of all, Sanjeev, do you think there's a minimum number of publishable evidence criteria that would allow companies to feel more comfortable and this is a tricky one, that the public would trust that minimal evidentiary kind of like a checklist or a toolbox?
Getting to it, we always go back to our wonderful regulators and what is minimally necessary to get out to market. And again, Leah mentioned that's also just a lot of compliance anywhere, so there's no minimal. I would only add that more and more companies now have roles such as chief patient officer. There's more voice of customers within an experiment at that experiment level. So it goes from top to bottom where you're really bringing that final endpoint customer into mind, as well as all the other stakeholders that are putting their votes in. So some of them don't have final review endpoint criteria. And that's another, it's not another problem. It's just that we, as we discover more, as you know, with more real-time continuous signal, with AI, with insight, or with the fact that we have more multi-dimensionality, it just adds for more that we have to do. And so not only do we not have enough of, as you said, okays and check marks evidentiary, but we keep adding more to the complexity in our lives. And so I don't have an answer for that, but I would say that it just openly welcomes more people into our industry, which sometimes tend to be sometimes thought of, oh, it's really hard to get into medical compliance, devices, technology, healthcare, engineering that's biologically related, drug development. With more of it, we need more. So it's, even with more humans,
So
hopefully
Liam,
we'll get better. We'll get better.
if I reframe that slightly and I said you as an engineer, I mean,
Yeah.
you go look for buying technology for yourself or your family. What do you look for? I mean, right now, so much of healthcare technologies are moving from enterprise-based to individual-based, where companies are saying, in the Super Bowl, all the ads there were all about, almost all of them are about drugs. And they were all trying to say, you need this drug, you need this intervention. So how do you, as an engineer, if you look forward into where the evidence ecosystem is changing, what would you look for as a single buyer, as a consumer patient, when you hear about digital health solutions?
And
Is
I
that
would
for
say,
me or
is that for,
Sandeep?
yeah, who are you
That's for
asking?
Liam, and then I'll give you Sanjeev an opportunity. Go ahead, Liam.
Sure, no problem.
Okay, sorry. Perfect. And a very good question. So I as an innovator, I love testing out the newest gadget, the newest idea, something looking at laterally and saying, hey, things I did in missiles, I was able to incorporate into the human body, from carbon fiber and nanotubes and technology and so on. So I'm always looking to experiment, but in testing these things, and it kind of goes back to what is the appropriate evidence, what is the appropriate sample sizes, even, sorry, my dogs are going crazy. One of those things, if we look in research, and say qualitative research, which would be phenomenological examination of human experience, is we only need about 12 to 15 people. So I'd like to actually see some of that type of, narrowing down of research subjects and participants in order for us to get things out. But from looking at new technology, I look at everything from, how was the board manufactured? Is there data leaks? Is this something that, I do these tests as an example, I'll compare this blood pressure cuff to this cuff and say, okay, this one's consistent on this data, but it has a problem with this data. So I look at it with the same rigor as if I was going to implant a pacemaker in a patient. I look in the sense of this, if my wife has experienced a cardiac event, this has got to be reliable to her that she's going to have confidence in. And it gets back to one final thing is, what Einstein said about if you can't explain it simply, you don't understand it well enough. It
Liam,
has to
I'll
be
call that
technology that's understood by everyone.
I will call it the grandmother test. I like that.
Yes, I like
All right.
that.
So we're wrapping up with time. So I'm going to ask a final question for each of you. Sanjeev, if you could change one thing tomorrow that you think would improve how enterprise digital health byproducts and research are generated and shared, what would that be?
If it's only one, thank you for that question. It's very good. If I can think of one thing, it would be looking a larger waft of humanity. Sometimes North America may not be the only place to do your work and research. There, as you know, the burgeoning population in other places, they're just amazing. If you just took travel to places you've not been, and you'll see how the world has advanced in places that you probably have never seen. And so I would like to see more openness of more patient data, more sites that could be used globally, more openness outside of what we consider as our usual bastions of strength, whether that's in healthcare, technology, engineering, whatnot. So it'll open your eyes. That's really what it is. You'll see that there's just a lot more people elsewhere. They're just not in the room yet.
That's nice. I agree completely. Liam, final thoughts on that question, and what do you think is one big thing that you think needs to change to get more published evidence in the journal THMT, as well as in the broader ecosystem of listeners and learning and the public? So, what is the thing that you would change if you had control to drive that?
And I love that because it's kind of a question I often ask my students about, what is the future? What's future forward thinking? What is something 5 to 10, 20 years out? And I'll be honest with you, though we get caught up on the AI hype and some of this, is when I look at things like anamorphic, agentic, narrow weak, we'll say empathetic, these type of, or we'll say versus true AI, is I truly believe, and if you look at some of the IEEE standards that are preparing to come out, is in AI coaching, in simulation, using AI to help me simulate modeling. For instance, when I think of human analogs or other things that help me create more data through AI simulation or whatever, is I can see whether it's in surgical procedures for or whether in innovation or in teaching, the use of AI coaching, still with governance and control. And when we think about even empathetic type AI, so I've been designing an empathetic AI system in thinking of how it actually can exhibit without, we'll say, objectively analyze data and exhibit the same characteristics we think about in research. So to me, AI systems that help us through AI coaching, and it could be agentic in this case, but things that are going to help me cover greater ground, explore more data, and still be able to meet the needs of this growing population who's well educated on the technology realm, but always with a caveat toward explanation, simplification, clarification, so people understand what I'm trying to accomplish.
Thank you both, Sanjeev and Liam, for your thoughtful discussion. I mean, it's obvious from our conversation today the important tensions in digital and enterprise research health. We're generating a lot of data. We're mostly not turning it into shared knowledge. It's clear that if we in the journal and others are going to be able to spearhead this broad dissemination and for this investment to reach its full potential, that means innovation and evidence generation has to work more closely together. And that means more transparency, more truth-telling, more credibility, and more democratization of the research ecosystem. If that happens, there's a faster movement of the field to learn and improve and ultimately to bring better population health. Thank you both for your time. Thank you for the audience. And looking forward to submissions to the journal. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Cindy.
Thank you.
All right, that's a wrap.
We appreciate you tuning in to the Telehealth and Medicine Today podcast series. Do you want to learn more or have a comment? Do you have a novel topic or solution to share with our audience? If so, send an email to info@partnersindigitalhealth.com or visit the open access peer reviewed journal Telehealth and Medicine Today and stay up to date with exciting articles that bridge research with real world frontline impact. Thanks for listening.